Hey, Bill.
Hello, Matt. Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year to you.
I suppose we should make a New Year's The Week in Blog announcement.
Let's do it. What news have you?
Well, word on the street is you're back.
Sort of. I was already accused of being Brett Favre. and nobody had to come down to, Hattiesville, Mississippi, fly down there and talk me into coming back. But I'm sort of back.
So we're going to have both you and Kristen Soltis rotating as conservative partners for the Week in Blog. And,
I think that'll be good. You know, you mix it up. You don't get burned out. You got, if you don't like me, you get her every other week. You don't like her. So
if you hate me, you're stuck.
If you hate Bill, you're
sometimes
stuck,
I take but... off. Other folks come in, but you mostly stuck with me.
I think I've gotten more hate mail, hate comments over the year than you. So maybe that's how it should be.
People were sad when you left. So I hope this announcement makes folks a little joyous for the new year.
Well, you know, we do what we can here, Bill. speaking of the new year, it has not been uneventful so far.
It is not. There's a new management in the U.S. House. There may be new management at the Republican National Committee.
Yeah.
There's new management at the White House.
You know, I told Obama that I could come in every other week, and me and Soltis could alternate with the chief of staff job. But
I'm sure there are some liberal bloggers who would have thought he would entertain that possibility.
Right. Yeah.
but before we get to the William Daley announcement, there's certainly a lot of fluidity in the RNC chair race. Have conservative bloggers picked sides? Are their favorite horses now? Are they playing a role in who wins this race, or is this all back room?
Not much. I mean, it's 168 members who get to vote, so it's the quintessential inside baseball story. The latest thing is Dan Real, a blogger at Real World, as you know, Bill, wrote a piece essentially arguing that there might be some sort of unholy alliance between the front runner. How do I pronounce his name? I don't even know. Priebus?
You're asking the wrong person.
He is the front runner, and he has ties.
It's Priebus, right? Last name's Priebus?
Priebus. I think that's right. He has ties to Haley Barbour, Mississippi Governor Haley Barbour. There's implication that this might be part of Haley Barbour's strategy to run for president. I don't know if that's like conspiratorial.
President of the Confederacy or Presidency of the United States?
good one, Bill.
Pretty sharp. A cheap shot for the new year.
Now, there's another candidate who has ties to another. I'm sorry, there's another candidate for RNC chair who has ties, at least another. I'm sure there are a lot of entangling alliances. But Saul Lanuzis, who is also running for RNC chair, formerly worked for American, or maybe currently, I don't know, worked for American Solutions, Newt Gingrich's organization, one of Newt Gingrich's organizations. So, you know, maybe it's a little bit. In other words, I'm sure that there are a ton of entangling alliances, and it may be a bit much to read too much into them. But what did happen is that Grover Norquist and Tucker Carlson from the Daily Caller co-sponsored a debate that I went to this week. There were like 500 people there, 75 reporters or more and bloggers who were there covering it. And I wanted to ask you, Bill, because this is actually the second annual the second debate that Americans for Tax Reform and Grover Norquist have put on.
They did one for 2008.
Yeah, when Steele was
2009, I should say.
Yeah, in 2009 when Michael Steele was, I guess January of 2009, when Steele was elected. But I wanted to ask you because didn't Democrats do something like this when Howard Dean was elected? Didn't they have a debate?
I don't remember.
I seem to recall.
You know, if they had a debate, it certainly wasn't a memorable one or a definitive one. I mean, I think Dean won that race, you know, in the back room. I don't say that in a negative way, just simply that he worked the actual DNC members who are largely not located in Washington, D.C.
Right.
And
in fact,
his
50-state only
strategy to them and said, I'm going to put more resources in your states than my predecessors have, and that's what sealed the deal.
And in fact, though, only 15 of the 168 or how many, I think 168 RNC members actually attended the debate. Out of 500 people in the room, only 15 or 16 were actually could actually vote. Now, I'm sure a lot of the other folks have read about it or watched it online. It was streaming at the Daily Caller and Americans for Tax Reform site. Another interesting thing that I wrote about, and so did John McCormick at the Weekly Standard, and so did somebody at the From Forum. Let me get you his name here. I don't normally read the From Forum, so the guy's name.
What's your user number 5 at the From Forum?
Tim, I'm client number 9. Tim Mack was the guy, the blogger's name, who both also wrote about this. That I'd forgotten, because, okay, so I'm here at this RNC chair debate, and you see Grover Norquist of Americans for Tax Reform and Tucker Carlson of the Daily Caller, obviously, were moderating. And it struck me that, I don't know if you knew about this, but these two guys had a feud, a knockdown, drag-out feud. In 1997, Tucker Carlson pinned a New Republic column on Norquist. The Slate noted, the article portrays Norquist as a buffoonish commissar who misplaced his principles to the extent of accepting money to lobby, yada, 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 on behalf of a Marxist government. Also, Tucker Carlson reportedly, and I believe this to be true according to a source of mine, poured a drink on Grover Norquist at a Weekly Standard function. This is back in the 90s. And as recently as 1997, Tucker told The Hill that Norquist is just a finger sniffer. And he went on to add, I'm not sure what that means, but it sounds sort of repulsive.
Yeah, I'm not sure what it means either.
These two guys had obviously a conservative feud, and they were teaming up. And I don't know what this means. I'm just reporting it. But they were co-sponsoring this RNC chairman's debate, which was quite interesting. And which the one thing I think we learned is that Michael Steele will not be reelected RNC chairman.
Is that a certainty? Do we know that there are a majority of RNC members who just will flat out not vote for him?
We don't know that, but you can construe that based on the fact that he is the incumbent. And so the fact that the vast majority of members are not committed to the incumbent implies to most observers and analysts that he cannot win.
Now, just so folks understand how this voting works, and correct me if my misunderstanding is wrong, so you have a first ballot, and you have multiple candidates on that ballot, and then it gets whittled down in every round until somebody eventually gets a majority. So not having a majority on the first ballot does not mean you won't get the majority on the third, fourth, fifth, or sixth ballot. I think
exactly
won the first time round after multiple ballots. Now, I guess the argument is that as the incumbent, he's not anybody's second choice.
Yeah, it really comes down
to win.
This is almost like Abraham Lincoln winning, the strategy he employed to win the nomination for president of the Republican Party, back in what 1860 or whatever. Essentially, the strategy is it's not about being anybody's favorite; it's about being the second or third favorite, or being tolerable to the most people. So
that's what Steele won the first time.
Yeah, he was like the compromise sort of tolerable guy, and he is no longer that.
I mean, isn't it possible that, you were at the debate, you know these players better than I do. I mean, none of these people running against him are household names. Is it possible that none of these people are terribly impressive? And then when it comes down to a third or fourth ballot, people might go, maybe Steele's actually the best of this lot.
Anything's possible, but I would say Steele has maybe a 5% chance of winning. So I wouldn't completely rule it out, but I would not bet on him. I would say
did anyone stand out in this debate that you attended? Did you notice any noticeable blog reaction after the debate too?
Ann Wagner, I think, did the best. She had a couple jokes. She had one that was a mistake. They asked what her favorite book was. She mistook that to be "What's Your Favorite Bar," but it worked out for her. It was kind of humorous. She's the one they asked, how many guns do you own? And she said, at least 16. She's not really sure. But she also was very charming and did it in a sort of appealing way. So I have to think she won the debate. Conservatives tend to like Saul Alinuzis. He's very new media savvy, former chairman of the Michigan Republican Party. He was very active on Twitter. He was, I don't know if he still is, but he was very tight with David Aul, the notable conservative new media guru. There's a lady named Maria Sino, who is obviously very smart. She's actually backed by Boehner and his people. But she is, and she seems to be a very good organizational person, like she can make the trains run on time. But she is sort of right out of central casting for a liberal. If I was casting like a liberal state senator from Maryland, Maria Sino, I think I'm pronouncing her name right, might get the call. In fact, she might be at the top of the list for the casting call. So, and then you get this previous guy who really did not impress at the debate, although he is currently leading in the whip count. So he is the front runner right now.
But now someone is clearly using A-Blog, Real World View, to try to derail his candidacy.
Could be. It wouldn't surprise me if someone's, you know, leaking information or whatnot. I mean, that certainly happens in the blogosphere. The other person that I didn't really mention much is Michael Steele, whose essential argument is, you can't prove I screwed up. That's basically his bumper sticker strategy.
Out of all these candidates, is there one candidate that bloggers on the right are rallying behind, or is it just not that clear cut?
I'm not seeing a lot of it resonate a lot in the blogosphere, primarily I think because people realize that it's a fool's errand to try to come out strong for somebody because you can't control who wins and you will look like you don't have power. So if Red State, for example, came out hard and said, Saul Alinuzis is our guy, and they came out like sort of full-throated, and I don't think, maybe I'm wrong and someone will go back and show me that they did do that, but I think that by and large most bloggers know that this is such inside baseball, you can't really influence this vote, and so you don't want to look like, you don't want to demonstrate that you don't have the power to accomplish something. So it's such inside baseball. I mean, I think bloggers have been generally covering it, but you haven't seen a ton of people rooting for one person or another. My guess is that Saul Alinuzis is the favorite of conservative bloggers because he ran last time. He's very pro, you know, new media friendly. And he has been endorsed by quite a few conservatives this time around. A lot of people some people who backed Ken Blackwell the last time as the conservative pick, this time are lining up behind Saul Alinuzis. I'm sorry, Bill.
When does this get decided?
It is January 14th, I believe, at the RNC winter meeting. I'm sure it's going to be on C-SPAN, yeah. So it's coming up soon. This is really quick. Again, it was something. You know, here I am at this room full of 500 people, hanging on to every word that these five candidates said. Like I said, there were like 75 members of the press and bloggers there. I mean, I saw Dave Weigel there. I saw Jonathan Martin of Politico. I saw Chris Saliza and Aaron Blake of The Washington Post. I sat next to Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm sure I'm missing some people. Some folks from Town Hall were there, where I used to write. So it was a big deal. And it's interesting that these debates are becoming a tradition now, where it used to literally be a backroom deal. At least now there's some transparency. Some things are being brought out in the open, although it's still...
seems a little bit for show. I mean, at the end of the day, it's still a backroom deal. I mean, is anything said in these debates as actually shaping the views of RNC members?
I think there's potential that there could. Again, it is a consummate inside baseball deal, but I do think that there's potential that that something could be said in one of these debates that could motivate people. But you're right. I think by and large, this is a brilliant marketing scheme, and I don't use the word scheme in a negative manner. I kind of admire this, but Grover Norquist is a very, very smart man, and I think this was his brainchild of the Americans for Tax Reform, and I think it was very smart because you decide you're going to have a debate, and they did it the right year when this sort of anger at the Republican establishment, the right zeitgeist was out there, and you get a couple people to commit, and then all of a sudden everybody has to attend the debate. You don't want to be the guy who didn't attend the debate because then it becomes an issue. So it's a great marketing strategy for Americans for Tax Reform and now the Daily Caller as well. And, you know, Tucker got to ask some questions.
Well, I think you've answered your own question why the feud between Tucker and Grover got passed.
Maybe it's a marriage of convenience. But it is fascinating. Again, this is a feud that lasted for over a decade. And apparently the hatchet has been buried.
Now, on the left side of the blogosphere, much discussion leading up to and soon after the choice for White House Chief of Staff, there was a lot of speculation in advance that it was going to be William Daley, and a lot of folks on the left were raising issues of Daley's Wall Street background. Not only was he Clinton's Commerce Secretary, but he's since then been working for J.P. Morgan Chase for several years, and noting his serving on the board of Third Way, the chief ideological enemy of the liberal blogosphere, and a column that he wrote basically accusing Obama of governing too far to the left and risking losing Congress in the midterms. And so you have Joe McCarter at Daily Kos now calling it the Third Way White House. You have Digby looking back at Daily's earlier Washington Post column saying making the case for surrender. But not even just folks on the more hardened blogosphere left, Ezra Klein, who generally is more sympathetic to some of the moderate moves of the administration, have called the Daley's choice sort of a mystery, and that perhaps Daley simply is an obscenely good executive vice president type. He seems to have impressed everyone who could one day promote him, alienated virtually no one. Or maybe the answer is that the Obama administration has simply decided to tack right. But at the end of the day, he says, Daley picks seems like a bad idea to me. The particular theory of politics he espouses is woefully detached from the realities of the modern partisan movement. You can sort of read this post as evidence that Daley is a singular political talent, and the Obama administration will be well served by hiring someone able to sustain these sorts of contradictions. But he said in the end, he just think so. He's a little more nuanced in his criticism than some others, but still thinks that having someone who is so openly disdainful of some liberal policy positions and liberal strategy is a bad choice. Is there any sense on the conservative side that Obama is brilliantly triangulating, or is this another example of the Chicago machine at work?
Both. There are probably three different tracks that I'm seeing conservatives and libertarian types and even mainstream reporters go down. An interesting tweet from Tim Carney over at the DC Examiner. And Tim Carney, for those of you who don't know, is a prime example of someone who has made essentially a life's work out of showing that conservatism and big business are not necessarily, and in fact, in many cases, are in opposition to one another. We've talked about this with Jonah Goldberg's book before about this this misnomer. But Carney writes or tweets, I've written about the split between the GOP's K Street wing and its Tea Party wing. Those endorsing Daley seem to fit into the former. But otherwise, we've got two sort of interesting things to discuss here. One, we've got conservatives like Ed Morrissey at Hot Air and John Tabet in American Spectator, who were essentially discussing a patronage quid pro quo sort of conspiracy theory that you've got, interestingly, Rahm Emanuel leaving the chief of staff position to go be mayor of Chicago. Meanwhile, the mayor of Chicago's brother, becomes the chief of staff. It's sort of like Throw Mama from the Train, right? The whole crisscross thing.
Well, except that's not the mayor of Chicago. It's his brother.
It's his brother, but, you know, people do favors. Look, I'm not saying I buy into the theory. I'm saying people are talking about it. But then there's the other point, which speaks more to what liberals are saying, and I'm seeing this from Chris Saliza at the Washington Post, not a conservative, and Doug Matakonis outside the Beltway, who's actually libertarian. They're both sort of echoing this point, but I'll read you what Matakonis says. The left wing of the Democratic Party will harp and they will complain, but as the ending weeks of the lame duck session proved quite emphatically, in the end, they will come back into the fold. And Saliza writes, without a serious figure on the ideological left weighing the idea of a primary challenge to Obama in 2012, yada, 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 the White House almost certainly believes there is little danger in making a move. So in other words, they don't care what the professional left has to think because they don't have the juice or there is no alternative. And look what happened in the lame duck session. Obama, you know, struck that compromise with Republicans, angered the left, and seems to have gotten a lot of what he wanted after that. So this may be a harbinger of things to come.
Well, keep in mind, he didn't anger the entirety of the left with that decision. You know, polls show that 60% of liberals supported the tax cut compromise.
There you go with your damn polls again. Lies, damn lies. There you go with your lies, damn lies, and statistics. you're pulling a Con Carroll on me, Bill.
But
you're sandbagging me with
left.
Numbers and quotes. And
there's definitely
statistics.
A portion of the left that was very angry with Obama over that decision, and this is the same portion of the left that's been angry with Obama over many decisions over the course of the last 2 years, and this just sort of adds to that pile. So I don't necessarily think that it worsens his standing with this faction of his base. It's just another complaint to add to the list. But you also have, you know, a bit of an outlying view in the blogosphere from Steve Bannon, the Washington Monthly, saying, I'm just not sure how much this matters. Rahm Emanuel exactly wasn't a choice to get excited about. His ideological instincts weren't quite reliable either. It's an open secret that Emanuel pleaded with Obama to forget about health care reform. As we know, the president ignored him and pursued the priorities he wanted to pursue. Making the point that at the end of the day, it's the policies that are going to matter, not the staff picks. And that is going to be the biggest question for this year, where the entirety of the progressive liberal base stands with Obama. What is he going to say about deficit reduction and Social Security in the State of the Union address and in his first budget? That's the issue that a lot of liberal bloggers are most anxious about. And if Obama doesn't embrace, you know, the Simpson-Bowles deficit reduction plan, then no one's going to care about the fact that William Daley's there. There are concerns that William Daley is going to lead Obama to embrace something like that.
Right. I think that's a fair point. I think it's true.
And I do think, to your other point, that Obama doesn't care about what the left has to say. I think that's partially true. He certainly is not, he's not second-guessing every move he makes based on what criticism he gets from certain high-profile bloggers. Obviously, it would be a much different administration if he did. But there is an example of Obama hiring Elizabeth Warren when there was such a drumbeat in the blogosphere from prominent economic voices, where it was really set up as a litmus test. Are you serious about Wall Street reform, following through on the law that you signed or not? And they bent over backwards to find a way to include her in the administration, even though there was a risk of a filibuster if she was forced to have a Senate confirmation. So I think the question for this month is, will there be a big enough drumbeat on Social Security and deficit reduction that whatever inclination the administration might have on those issues, they have to stop and say, wait a second, is this one going to really shatter the base and not just be, you know, a bit of, you know, peanut gallery heckling?
Fair enough. I think it's something to keep an eye on, as I always say. I think in and of itself, maybe not a big deal, but maybe a harbinger of things to come, depending on how things shake out.
Right. Going back to the conservative side, the early jockeying for the presidential nomination has already begun, even though no one's formally thrown their hat in the ring. And so there's already debate scheduled for the spring. There's already people going to Iowa and New Hampshire, of course. But I was struck on Red State today. Eric Erickson had a post chastising some of the commenters for being too obnoxious to other commenters in touting their preferred candidates. And it just struck me as odd that people are already choosing up sides before anyone's even actually announced they're running. And Red State seems to be trying to position itself as being a real hotbed of public opinion as it comes to 2012.
Yeah, well, I think that the comments are happening. Some of them are organic, but more likely these are trolls. When I worked at townhall.com, I mean, I'm convinced that the campaigns had people, either volunteers or paid people, who would go on and try to work the refs and the other commenters, so to speak. So I think it happens. And, you know, maybe Eric's sort of calling them out early. They're going to start banning people. I mean, last time around, the Ron Paul people got essentially excommunicated from Red State, as I recall. It is interesting. You know, none of the candidates running right now, I think, save for Sarah Palin, are really going to engender a lot of organic enthusiasm from average people. I do want a quick shameless self-promotion plug. I did an interview with Tim Pawlenty today, which I think is maybe the most...
For the blogger of the podcast.
For the Politics Daily. And I think it might be the most interesting interview. I'm not saying it's earth-shattering, but, you know, in terms of Tim Pawlenty being a kind of Midwestern, Minnesota nice guy, this was, an interesting interview, and he said some things which were newsworthy, well, minorly, from a minor level newsworthy, but at least quotable. So check that out. But that's my shameless self-promotion. The real story is that Red State is now seemingly behind Mike Pence. You know, 4 years ago they got behind Fred Thompson early. That did not work out well. But it might have gotten Fred Thompson in the race. Actually, they might have drawn him in the race. But, you know, Mitch Daniels for a while seemed to be Eric Erickson's favorite. But I don't know if he was turned off by some of the things Daniels has said about having...
Sort of kneeled the social conservatives to some degree.
Exactly, about having a truce on social issues. Or if he doesn't think Daniels is going to run. But in a post a couple days ago, Eric Erickson wrote, "Right now I'm not excited or inspired by any of them save Sarah Palin. And as much as I love Sarah Palin, I'm adamantly convinced that she cannot win given the ridiculous smears and hate thrown her way by the Democrats and, frankly, a lot of Republicans." He goes on to write, that Mike Pence bridges the gap between the establishment and the grassroots. He is in the comfort zone of both, and essentially making the argument that because Mike Pence is the only guy who bridges this gap between the establishment and the grassroots, and I would say between the fiscal conservatives and the social conservatives, who both love him. Mike Pence is a guy equally at home at the Family Research Council, where, by the way, he won their straw poll last year, and the Club for Growth, who loves him. So Mike Pence is well-positioned. Now, there are a lot of problems with him, including the fact that he's a member of the House of Representatives, that he might run for governor, that I don't know if he can raise the money, but he's got a lot going on for him, and the latest is apparently an endorsement by Red State and Eric Erickson.
It seems like Red State, in trying to make this case, is, you know, trying to draw Pence in, because the conventional wisdom is that Pence was more likely to run for governor of Indiana, has a much clearer shot there. Not, you know, Republicans are generally ascendant in the state. The Democratic candidate might be the guy who got completely whipped by Dan Coats in the Senate race. Evan Bayh is not going to run, who's the most popular Democrat in Indiana. Whereas if Pence ran for president, crowded field, not a household name nationally. No one's won from the House in a century. So that's a far bigger risk. And Erickson's basically pleading him, take the risk. We'll be here for you. We'll catch you. Ask Fred Thompson. So
and it's really a shame that Pence didn't run for Senate. He could have won. He could have been there with Toomey and Rubio and Lee and Paul and the rest instead of Dan Coats. But, yeah, look, I think it's hard to read the tea leaves, though, because if you look at where Pence is traveling, he's doing a lot of traveling within Indiana, which implies he's going to run for governor because he doesn't really need to. I mean, he's going to win his home state, presumably. But he's also doing some traveling to places, I forget the latest, but like South Carolina or Iowa. So is it a fact that he's honoring some previous commitments he made when he was weighing a presidential run, but he's decided on the governor? I don't think we know. I think it's really up in the air. But, yeah, I think you're right. This is Eric Erickson basically pleading to Mike Pence to run. And let me say this, too. The other thing about Pence, he is great on TV. I think he was a broadcaster. I don't know if he's a radio guy or a TV guy or what, but
I might suggest that great is strong.
I think he's very good. I think he's very good on TV. But
I mean, I wouldn't call him an electric personality.
I can't believe you just are dissing Mike Pence like this. I'm a little bit hurt. I call him the Silver Fox.
I mean, he's well media trained. He speaks, cleanly and crisply. He doesn't get knocked off message, all that sort of thing. But
yeah, well, the thing though, he combines a lot of things that I think Rubio has. Obviously, there's some things that he doesn't have that Rubio has. He's not as young or as Hispanic as Rubio, but he's like just as conservative as some of the prominent conservatives out there, but he's smart and experienced. So a lot of times these can be like mutually exclusive, right? You run into a situation where like the competent, credible, serious, smart people are liberal, and then you've got these populist, crazy right wingers. But Pence is in many ways the real deal, the whole package. He appeals to the establishment and the grassroots. And he appeals to Christians, Christian conservatives, just as much as Huckabee. But remember, Huckabee and the Club for Growth hated each other. They called him the Club for Greed. Pence is the darling of the Club for Growth. So he really does.
It sounds like you like Mike Pence.
Well, I like a lot of things about Mike Pence. I'm not convinced that he could win the presidency as a member of the House. I'm not convinced he could raise the money. I'm not convinced he could build an organization that could win the presidency. So I like a lot about him in terms of policy, but in terms of being John Madden and sitting back and saying, can he win? I'm skeptical.
Now, I'm curious about this comment that Erickson made about Sarah Palin, not just you can't win, but that you can't win because the media won't let her win because of all the smears that are foisted upon her. And I've heard this from other conservatives that I've personally crossed. It strikes me as a bit of a rationalization to say that she can't win because of what other people are going to do to her. Is there some sort of tacit acknowledgement there that she herself is not ready for prime time on the national stage? She's ready for prime time to sell books and reality TV shows, but not to be commander in chief.
Well, I can't speak for Erickson. And by the way, he ended up a couple days later. So he wrote this on January 3rd. A couple days later, he wrote another piece, a follow-up piece, essentially saying, I still like Sarah Palin. I'm not saying I don't like Sarah Palin. I'm saying I don't think she can win. I don't think she's going to run. But if she did run, I would support her, or something to that effect. So clearly the Palin people who are prone to do did a little pushback on this. And maybe some people misconstrued it. Maybe some people represented this as, instead of the headline being Red State Backs Pence, maybe some people were pushing Erickson doesn't believe Palin can win, that meme, which wasn't the big story here. But let me just, I'll tell you, instead of putting words in Eric's mouth, I'll basically tell you what I think, which is, like, even maybe a year ago or so, I agreed with what Eric said in the sense that Palin did get amazingly negative treatment by the media for a long time, and I think a lot of it was really, really unfair. And some of it was very egregious, like the Trig birther stuff. But in the past...
But that stuff's not what's holding her back to be president.
Well, let me say this. In the past year, I think Palin has done a lot of stuff that I disagree with strategically and tactically, and if I'm John Madden, I'm going to say that's a bad play. And I think that she's antagonized the media to some degree and hidden from them in other regards. So I think, yeah, it's a little bit of playing the victim card here to say she can't win because they won't let her. Ronald Reagan was just as conservative as Sarah Palin, and he's known as the great communicator. That's all I have to say about that.
Now, is there any blogosphere reaction to this Michelle Bachmann tease? Because I presume that Michelle Bachmann would only throw her hat in the ring if Sarah Palin didn't. There's not room for
well,
to charitably say that style of politician.
I don't know much about it. I've not followed much, but I did ask Tim Pawlenty his take on that. Obviously, he was the governor of Minnesota, and Michelle Bachmann is a congresswoman from Minnesota, and he said, "Well, it's a free country. Anyone can run. Anyone can run that's over the age of 35. And then he added, "I have respect for Michelle Bachmann. I've had a cordial and positive relationship with her." The blogosphere and the Twitter sphere have people. It's a lot of people in the conservative side really like Michelle Bachmann, and they really like the fact that she tells it like it is and doesn't back down. And so there's a market for that.
There's definitely a strain of conservatives that like Sarah Palin, but will say, "But I know she can't win." Are there folks out there going to say Sarah Palin can't win, but Michelle Bachmann can? I mean, I would think that the logic would apply to both candidates.
And I think this is more, my guess is this is more of a public relations move for Bachmann. It's a great way to get publicity. I don't know what the end game is. But remember, she was going to run for RSC conference chair or something that Jeb Hensarling, she ended up backing down from that. She was going to challenge Jeb Hensarling. And there were conservatives, including myself, and I believe Eric Erickson, who basically came out and said, "Look, you can't get any better than Jeb Hensarling." The notion that he's not a Tea Party candidate was funny. And how do you beat a guy who had 100% rating from the Club for Growth? How do you argue that he's a liberal? That was like the last time she ran for something or said she was going to run for something and got publicity out of it. So we'll see, but who knows? I mean, Sean Hannity is a big supporter of hers, and Michael Steele's the frequent guest, and I believe he's been known to weigh in and to endorse and to make phone calls, and that could have an effect in some quarters.
So the last topic before we wrap up for this week, there is some friction going on with the CPAC conference. This is the annual, the biggest annual conservative conference every year. And I think last year, this new conservative gay group, GOP Proud, which is different than Log Cabin Republicans.
I call it Go Proud. And I don't know if I just...
Maybe that's the proper way to...
I think it is, but I could be wrong. But I think it's Go Proud.
But Go Proud is, you know, gay conservatives who are, you know, they're conservative. They're conservative who happen to be gay.
Right.
And whereas Log Cabin Republicans, I think, have more of a you know, moderate centrist, you know, veneer. Ann Coulter spoke at the Go Proud convention earlier. But there are some conservatives that are so CPAC has allowed them to be part of the conference, and some conservatives are saying CPAC is betraying the conservative cause for letting these folks in.
Right. Well, first, before we get to CPAC, I just want to quickly mention the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, which is part and parcel of this debate. And there was an interesting blog debate about whether or not it was good. And see, people tend to think that Republicans and conservatives are monolithic and that they all have the same viewpoint. But that's really not true. And more I'm seeing that on the issue of legalization. I'm seeing it on
There even was a suggestion by Sarah Palin's Twitter feed that she actually might be supportive of the Don't Ask, Don't Tell repeal.
That's right. She retweeted.
Oh, she hasn't come right out and said it herself, but she retweeted something that was favorable.
Right. There's a radio host named Tammy Bruce. And Tammy Bruce is actually the chairperson of the Go Proud Advisory Board. And Tammy Bruce had tweeted something essentially talking about hypocrisy of some Republicans having to do with Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And Sarah Palin retweeted it. And some people took that to be an endorsement. Now, my understanding is that retweets do not necessarily constitute an endorsement, but I believe Tammy Bruce interpreted it that way, and certainly some other people did as well. And Palin hasn't spoken out on this since that time, as far as I know. Maybe she has, or maybe she will by the time this airs. But so anyway, conservatives aren't monolithic. There are a lot of nuanced opinions. But there was, a fascinating debate between Robert Stacey McCain, the other McCain, as he goes by, and Jonah Goldberg. Jonah Goldberg had written a syndicated column, I guess a column for the L.A. Times. He's normally with the National Review, but he writes a column for the L.A. Times. And he wrote a piece essentially making the argument that that basically, here you have gay people willingly entering into the institution of marriage and the institution of the armed forces. And so we should celebrate this as conservatives having won. Even gays want to get married and have monogamous relationships and enter the army. I mean, so that's a win that conservative values have triumphed. Robert Stacey McCain disagreed and argued that the radicalization of traditional institutions, and I'm paraphrasing here, the radicalization of traditional institutions does not equal the bourgeoisification of gays or something to that effect. So here you had two conservatives, though, essentially disagreeing over whether or not the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell was a good thing, and whether or not it actually proved that conservatism is triumphing. So I say all that.
I mean, has there been a change in the conservative dialogue on this after the repeal vote? So after, you know, whatever, you know, politics is taken out of it, you know, Obama got the win. That's done. Do conservatives feel a bit more comfortable than talking about the issue in on the ideological merits because it's not going to be part of a who wins, who loses game anymore?
I don't think so. That does happen a lot, Bill. But in this case, conservatives have really been divided on this issue for a long time. I wrote a piece a few months ago where I quoted a ton of conservatives who were in many ways pro-gay. And this was on the heels of Ann Coulter speaking at a Go Proud event. It's unclear to me whether or not... So Dan Foster, who's a blogger at National Review, argued that this is a very Burkean thing. You know, Edmund Burke, many people think the kind of intellectual father of conservatism, who was for the American – he's a British parliamentarian. He was for the American Revolution. He was against the French Revolution. And he believed in sort of things evolving and that it's conservative for things to evolve over time. Dan made an argument to me that this was sort of Burkean, that our society had progressed to such a point where now gays maybe could serve openly and it wouldn't have the radical or negative impact that it would have had 10, 15, 20 years ago. I mean, it's an intellectual discussion, and it's not a rigid discussion that some people have had. So I don't think that's the case in this instance. I think that for a while now there's been a lot of division. I'm thinking S.E. Cupp was a prime example of somebody I talked to, a conservative who, in many ways, was sort of pro-gay. But this is having...
What does this mean for CPAC?
Well, what this means for CPAC is trouble. We've got, Go Proud is like a co-sponsor. I think CPAC had a vote. They will not say, even people, the board of directors voted on whether or not Go Proud should be allowed. to sort of be a co-sponsor, or whatever they're calling it. They've changed the name of that co-sponsorship, but whatever they're calling people who co-sponsor, nobody knows who, how, you know, what the vote was, but GoProud was allowed to continue their partnership with CPAC, and as a result, at least two prominent conservative groups, one the Family Research Council, which is very powerful, and one Concerned Women for America, are boycotting. There are other groups like the Heritage Foundation that will not be participating in CPAC this year, although it is not because of the GoProud event, or at least it doesn't appear to be because of that.
Are they trying to compete?
Well, it'll be there could be a social conservative group, you know, event could spring up. There used to be one called the Conservative Leadership Conference that used to compete against CPAC. That stopped happening about a decade ago. But there was competition to try to be the biggest conservative sort of meeting in D.C. each year. And you might see a conservative CPAC. But Bill, the reason this is significant, or the reason this could be significant, is that there's a guy named Frank Meyer, who is a conservative leader, who many, many decades ago came up with this thing he called fusionism. And Bill Buckley sort of incorporated this into his magazine, National Review. So we're talking about like 50, 60 years ago. And the notion of fusionism was that that social conservatives and national security conservatives and fiscal conservatives could only win if they joined together. And so there was this tacit sort of unwritten rule that said, if you're a social conservative and you think raising taxes might be good because it might help poor people, just don't go that route, because you're going to upset the apple cart, this coalition we've cobbled together. And likewise, if you're a fiscal conservative, you might have no problem at all with gays, but keep it to yourself, because we got to keep this coalition together, because it's the only way we can win. Reagan won with that coalition, and in fact, the truth is, Republicans and conservatives really didn't win elections until the Christian conservatives were the last element of what's known as the three legs of the conservative movement. They were the last group to come on board, and it wasn't until social conservatives joined in that Republicans and conservatives started winning elections regularly.
Right. The one CPAC that I attended, I heard that three-legged stool mantra repeated at least 100 times over the course of the proceedings. That seems to be very much in the fabric of what CPAC sees itself being.
Right, and now one of those stools at least is coming apart. There is I don't want to read too much into this. It is just a conference after all. But it is entirely possible that this fusionist notion is unraveling. And who knows what that means. But it's something I keep a close eye on as conservatism becomes more libertarian, as social conservatives find themselves out in the cold. Are they going to go rogue? And if they do, if history is an indicator, Republicans can't win without them. In some ways, some people have argued that social conservatives could have ended up being part of the liberal coalition. In other countries, you see that, where there's like this social justice movement, and where Christianity, my light just went out, Christianity is much more tied to the left than to the right.
Well, and Jimmy Carter's candidacy was sort of an example of how that coalition could be put together.
Yeah, exactly. So this could have, I'm going to say it again, Bill, but like, I don't want to read too much into it right now, but this could have long-term implications going forward. Meanwhile, GoProud has been very smart. It's unclear to me whether or not they are just really cool people who want to be a part of something, or whether this is like a brilliant move to actually infiltrate the conservative movement. I mean, think of it this way. Not only are gays sort of winning the gay debate nationally, they're winning it within the conservative movement. That they're winning that argument within the conservative
movement. They have a secret agenda to win policy rights.
Well, here's the deal, Bill. It used to be 20 years ago that you could point to kind of like radical militant homosexual groups who looked and acted radical. Now you've got gay conservatives, who frankly, in many cases, are a lot nicer to me than than social conservatives. They retweet me sometimes. They return my calls. So you know where I'm going with this, but it's a fascinating.
What you're going is that CPAC's going to be a much better party this year.
Well, I think I don't want to talk about shattered glass and Stephen Glass, but let's just say the fashion will be better. Because I tell you something I like about the gays. They do not wear those stupid short neck ties. They don't wear a lot of the Gadsden flag T-shirts. They dress much better. They're much better dressed.
There are buttons around where I went to college, you know, back in the ye olde early 90s that said, "We dictate your fashion."
Well, at a lot of Republican
maybe
meetings,
maybe that should be the button of choice at CPAC.
A lot of Republican meetings, they don't, because you get those elephant neck ties, which are typically hideous. So, you know, I will say this: I'm with the gays when it comes to fashion. To be sure, I want them dressing me.
I will quote you repeatedly.
As long as you quote me in full.
Perhaps we should leave it on that note. Matt, it's good to have you back.
Always, always fun. Always a delight, Bill. And I look forward to our not mutually exclusive, our sort of open relationship that we're having here on Politics Daily now, right?
All right.
All right. Well, happy New Year, and we'll see you next week. I won't, but Bill will see you next week on This Week on The Week in Blog. Adios.
That's right. You almost remembered it.
Almost. It's been a long time. See ya.
Take care.